Today, Jonas and I are talking with Julien Le Goc. Julien is the Director of Policy at the Diem Association, formerly known as the Libra Association. We talk about the reasons for renaming Libra to Diem. Julien gives us an insight into the new vision of Diem. And of course, we try to get an answer on the question, when is Diem going to launch? So, hello and welcome to this special episode of Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock and Roll. As you can hear, the episode today is going to take place in English. And the reason is our very special guest. We have Julien today as a guest from Diem, from the Diem Association, formerly known as Libra Association. So, Julien, it's really great to have you on the show and thanks for being here today.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you today and thank you for the invite. And I apologize that my college German is not good enough for all of your listeners. So apologies in advance.
So I was already quite impressed when you welcomed me with some German words. So it's better than you think you're German.
Danke.
Anyway, I will hand over right away to Jonas for a quick introduction of Julien, and then I suggest we start right away with a big news, with a rebranding of the Libra Association to Diem, and then let's just see where we get from there. So, Jonas.
Perfect. Thanks, Alex. So, to quickly introduce Julien, Julien joined the Diem Association, or formerly known as Libra Association, in 2019 and is currently Director of Policy at the Diem Association. Before joining the association, Julien had worked for the US Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. And Julien, as Alex already said, we are really thrilled to have you today as our guest. So to start the conversation, I mean, there was a really big announcement just quite recently, right? So that basically the whole project has been renamed. So the Libra project has been renamed to Diem. Also, the association has been renamed to the Diem Association. And to start the discussion, it would be really great if you could just explain why you basically did the rebranding. So what were your main motives?
Yeah, good question. Thank you, Jonas. So you're absolutely right. Just a few days ago, in really marking the next step in the evolution of the project, we renamed it from Diem, from Libra to Diem. And as you know, Diem is a Latin for day. And with it, you know, we are hoping to signal that it's really a new day for the project. And you may recall an artist named Prince, formerly known as Prince when he changed it to the icon. And so now I feel like every time I'm saying we're formerly Libra, now Diem, I think of Prince in my mind. But the important, I think what's really important about this renaming, in addition to kind of the marking this independence of the project, is we have a new vision. And this vision is to enable universal access to financial services. And that is an upgrade, so to speak, from kind of our old vision. Because as we were going through this project, we quickly realized that what we are building really is this digital payment system. So think of it as a global digital plumbing with pipes, essentially enhancing individuals' access to financial services. And the second thing that was important was for us to revisit our mission. And our mission has evolved into building a trusted and innovative financial network that empowers people and businesses around the world. And what's important here, I think, is the link between people and businesses. And of course, businesses are operated by people. But we wanted to ensure that we had a mission that also looked at the marketplace and that was not just solely focused on individuals. So it was an additional step in the independence of the project, as well as, you know, in support of the new leadership's commitment to enhancing the security and the regulatory compliance of the global payment system that we're building ahead of its planned launch.
Before, you had these two goals, right? It was cross-border payments and financial inclusion. So to me, it sounds a bit that you shifted a bit more towards this second part, so towards financial inclusion, or is it still also a cross-border payments a big thing, or is it something completely new what you're doing now?
Yeah, good question. So Certainly, remittances are a core use cases for the DM project. As you know, we currently have 1.7 billion individuals that are excluded from the formal economy. Digital currencies offer, you know, yet another solution that can drive down costs. And more importantly, we still have our eye on the prize with the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. I'm sure you've heard of goal number 10, for example, that over the next decade wants to lower remittance fees from a stubbornly high 6.8%, according to the World Bank's latest data, down to 3%. And some corridors, as you know, the like a Germany to Turkish to Turkey corridor is quite an expensive one. But with this average, I don't believe that unless you have large scale innovation and progress, that we're going to reach that goal within the next decade. So remittances are still clearly a core mission of the DM project.
You mentioned, Julian, that basically one of your goals basically now is also to provide universal access to financial services. And this is, of course, also related to financial inclusion, as we discussed. Mm-hmm. And what I now ask myself is, from my perspective, this kind of means that everybody should basically get, or kind of almost everybody should get access to the infrastructure. But I mean, the thing is, of course, that also KYC, AML topics are currently quite important. And also that lots of individuals, for example, in developing economies don't have even an ID, right? So here in your previous proposal, you had the idea of these unhosted wallets where you can basically also participate without really identifying yourself with an ID or something. My question would be, are these unhosted wallets still intact, or have they even strengthened because you kind of, it seems that you have a bigger focus now on these universal access as well?
Yeah, thank you for the good question. And I'll answer it in a roundabout way to provide a little bit more context to your listeners. And I think it's important to start with the human aspect, which I think is where you started out with. And then I can actually give you a personal aspect on all this. But the current challenge or the opportunity, depending on if you see the glass half full or half empty, is will reveal itself once we start talking a little bit more about this common cause and where I think private sector innovation and the future of payments should really be welcomed. We talked about the 1.7 billion people that don't have access to this modern financial system, right? We're trying to solve for that by having universal access to financial services. I see this, in fact, as a global risk. We also have approximately the same amount of individuals that are underbanked. Jonas, what that means is individuals that leverage alternative financial services. So they may go to merchants that have extremely high fees. We're talking hundreds of percent for loans, for example, or to cash checks. And so what we've seen over the past 10, 15 years is through a policy of de-risking, we have a high price that's been exacted on the people that can really afford it the least. So now I'm going to get to the crux of your question. What we have at our fingertips, we have solutions today and cutting edge technologies like blockchain that are going to help us. But that's not enough. We need connectivity. We need the internet. We need global digital identities, which you brought up. In an environment when you can have all these items together, we start moving the needle from what has typically been abstract to what becomes concrete. The project that was launched in June last year, the now DM project, I think is one aspect in being able to move that needle. One of the things that we saw that I believe is encouraging is all of the discussion we've had now, whether it's with global stakeholders or authorities members of different communities, blockchain communities and financial inclusion communities, is that there's a real need now to start setting up really the pillars of what should be almost like a human right, to be honest with you. And so right now, you know, you have access to banking depending on the zip code or the family that you come from. A digital identity should also be a common cause, a common good. You should be able to be born essentially with a digital identity to be able to have access to the modern financial system. So those two things are not exclusive, Jonas. There's a lot of work that remains to be done. Your question about unhosted or self-hosted wallet is still an important one. clearly the discussion that we've had with nations that have a large percentage of unbanked, they have indicated that a self-hosted wallet could lower the barriers to entry into the modern financial system. Now, if we take a look at an example like M-Pesa in Kenya, M-Pesa that came around was sponsored by Vodafone. They managed to almost overnight halve the amount of unbanked individuals by having the technology that was readily available to the individuals that have a smartphone. So although regulators and stakeholders have been clear from the FSB and from others like FATF in their travel rule that they want to ensure that they have an understanding of who is receiving money and who is sending money. As you know, FATF put in place last year clear guidelines on what a regulated virtual asset service provider and their requirements should be, as well as the countries that essentially would be part of this. It's quite clear that from a project's perspective, it is going to be a phased approach where we first work with regulated VASPs and then we move on. But I agree with you that this self-hosted wallet is still an important discussion point for global stakeholders as well as inside of the Diem project.
Let's maybe go back to the question, what led to the decision of rebranding from Libra to Diem? And I would be especially interested into the role Facebook played in this decision, because my personal first reaction was when I read this, okay, this is apparently a way of trying to communicate even clearer that Libra is not the same as Facebook, and that the Libra, or now the Diem coin, is not a Facebook coin, but it's an independent institution where Facebook, of course, plays an important role, but it's not the same. So my question would be, which role did this general opinion that was swirling around that Facebook and Libra is the same, which role did this play in the rebranding of the name?
Great question. So Facebook, through their wallet provider, Novi, is one of 27 members. And therefore, they had as much voting power as any of the other members. And in fact, this name was put up for a vote at the association, at an assembly. And so Facebook had no more voting power than anybody else in renaming the project to Diem.
So Julian, I mean, I understand that Facebook has only one vote, and I also found it a bit unfair that Libra and Facebook was treated basically as the same, and that many people called it a Facebook coin instead of Libra coin. But I also understand it a little bit because, of course, Facebook initiated the project, right, or at least played a very, very important role. And Facebook, of course, has, at least in the beginning, put a lot of funding, but also human resources into the project. So can you maybe give us a bit of a view behind the scenes, which role Facebook still plays apart from this one vote, which I understand, but also are there mainly Facebook developers sitting on the project, or is this a more healthy mix now?
So Facebook remains, and Novi, they remain an important member, of course, of the association. Therefore, you're right. There are still Facebook, and Novi is actively participating in the project, as are other members. And that's really important to state, is that even on the TSC, the 7-member technical steering committee, Novi has one seat. There are 6 other seats, same as on the board with 5 seats. Novi has one seat. So they are not playing any more role than they would have any other member can. We have other working groups within the association. For example, we had a communications working group that we stood up. We have a policy working group. And so members may join these groups or may not, and may contribute as much as they can or they not.
So I started this podcast almost at the same time as the first white paper was published. So it's kind of the podcast and Libra are kind of the same age. So I would be really interested in maybe walking through these last, 1.5 years roundabout, and maybe from your perspective, like, going through the major milestones from your point of view, right? Maybe let's restrict it to 4 or 5 at max. So maybe starting with the first white paper, or maybe even before, if there has happened something before which we didn't know, from your perspective, what were like the major milestones, and how did this all play out from your perspective? Because I can imagine it was a hell of a ride the last 1.5 years.
Well, you're right. It sure was. And what I have to show for it is I have more gray hairs, a lot of air miles that I can't use during this pandemic, and a few more kilos is what I typically say. But so I think from the outset here, the 4 or 5 milestones, one would be in October of 2019, we had our first General Assembly, which was like a council meeting, where we voted on the charter. And so that indicated kind of the true independence of the project was to sign that charter. The second,
so just to give some perspective to the listeners, in June 2019, you published the first white paper. And it's I find it really interesting that you say October 2019 with the inauguration of the Libra Association, this was your first major milestone because it marked the independence. So a couple of months after the first white paper was released, basically.
Correct. And I'll tell you why I didn't state the white paper 1.0 as the first milestone, because in my mind and in hindsight, it was a quite aspirational white paper that really got the discussion flowing with global stakeholders, which was great. We've learned a lot through this type of discussion, and I'm sure you'll ask me about kind of the talks that we've had with regulators over the past 18, 19 months and kind of my perspective on this. But so I think the October 2020, the independence of the project was critical. And then I'm going to go straight to the updated white paper in April. Now, we announced new members, which I think were great, strong members added to the project. But the second white paper was the big milestone. And then the third milestone is going to be the operational readiness over the past 3-4 months, being able to hire world-class talent from our CEO, Stuart, that comes, of course, from HSBC, and he was the first undersecretary under Bush and Obama for counterterrorism in the United States federal government. Steve Bunnell used to be the general counsel for the Department of Homeland Security. Sterling Danes, our chief compliance officer, used to head compliance at Credit Suisse. Dalia Maki now as kind of our chief technology officer and an expert, if not the expert in blockchain technology and the inventor of a hot stuff language. So, you know, I think the real third milestone has been being able to hire world-class talent to this project and how far we've gone now in the past 18 months.
So you just called it operational readiness. So is DM operationally ready? Could you start tomorrow, if like from a technological or operational perspective?
Yeah, good question. So we have 3 trains that need to arrive, and I'm using a Swiss analogy since I spent a third of my life in Switzerland. They always run on time, right? So the 3 trains that need to arrive on time. One, from a technology perspective, to answer your question, technologically, we are almost ready. We, you know, are in the stages of conducting testing on the network and resilience on the network and developing all the appropriate documentation to support this network to ensure that we have an external audit, of course, that passes. So from a technology perspective, I think we're almost there. From an operational readiness, we are also almost there. You know, the hiring of key staff members, ensuring that we develop processes and procedures. And you have to remember, guys, that, you know, we're only 18, 19 months old. And so, you know, we also, as an organization, we have to develop internal policies and procedures and certain things that may seem, you know, very basic to large organizations. When you're a startup, you need to put pen to paper. And the third one is really the one that tells us the timing of the launch, and that is regulatory approval. As you know, we've been working with FINMA and the regulatory college that includes 20 members and authorities and regulatory bodies around the world. We have initiated our payment system license and something that may be interesting.
You're addressing a very important point. So basically you say that you will just launch, as you also basically explained last year as the Libra Association, that you will just launch as soon as you have regulatory approval. As you might know, there has been this this rumor a few weeks ago that arguing that in January it could potentially be the case that you will introduce like a part product like your US dollar Libra coin. Can you also elaborate on this? So do you think this is like not possible because you will wait for regulatory approval? So it's just wrong, or what's your stance on, what's your comment on this one?
Yeah,
Julian,
so
you can be open. We are among ourselves. So
no, absolutely. Of course. And I am. I'm trying to be open and transparent, of course. It's just us. So here's the truth. The truth is we will not launch unless we get a green light from FINMA. And so can we be ready for launch? Sure. Do I think we're close to being ready for launch? Absolutely. I talked about the organizational readiness and the technology, but we knew that that third pillar was really the pillar that will give us the green light for launch.
Thank you for your very, very clear answer here, Julian. If we assume that FINMA will accept this license whenever it is, what do you think how long it takes you then to launch?
As you know, we are not the only players in this ecosystem. We are working with different large financial institutions to be designated dealers. We're working with digital wallet providers. And so there are still several steps that need to happen before we can launch. But I would think that it would be several weeks for us to kind of turn the switch. And you brought up, starting in certain jurisdictions versus other jurisdictions. I think that's accurate. I think we've seen, for example, in Europe with their crypto asset regulation, which we can talk a little bit about. They have a different stance than others. There are certainly some jurisdictions that are more, I call them bellwether regulators. Examples of that, in Singapore, throughout this whole Singapore FinTech Week, it's been clear that they are very, very forward on digital assets, and there are other jurisdictions. So I think it's a combination of ensuring that legally we can operate in the particular jurisdiction, that we have the technology, that we are operational ready, and that we have our license. So there are a lot of moving parts. It's fairly complex. But I am hoping that by early next year, all of these pieces come together at the same time for us to turn on the network.
So for someone who is deep into the topic and also has an overview of what's going on the regulatory side in Europe, especially, I think it's pretty clear that it will be impossible for Diem to start with a euro stablecoin, right? Because there has been a new regulatory proposal published a couple of months ago by the European Commission called Markets in Crypto Assets, MiCA. And I would be really interested in your take on that, because for me, it seemed to be really mainly targeted at Libra. So really a regulation almost exclusively written for you. And yeah, what's your impression about that? And do you agree that this at least makes it in the short term quite difficult for you to get going in Europe at least, or in the euro area?
Yes, well, I completely agree with you. Whenever I saw global stablecoins, I felt like the regulation was aimed completely at us. So I'm with you on that. So I think the proposal or the proposals, they're intended to create this innovation-friendly type framework. That doesn't pose obstacles to any type of application of new technology, while having a common approach for kind of the single euro era. So I think that's good. The other thing that I think is good is that they are currently, these proposals are just proposals. They still have to go through the whole legislative process that may take 2 years, 3 years. So I think a lot can happen in a year or two in this particular industry. Now, there are certain things that I also think were beneficial from the regulation. One, these proposals are really comprehensive. Can they achieve the goal of mitigating risk and better protecting consumers? I think so. Now, other things that I like about these proposals: one, it sets out clear regulation. You know exactly where you stand if you want to operate on the euro area. The passporting nature, I think, is fantastic. I think the proposal of having just one regulator, or what I call one belly button to push, the EBA is also positive. Now, for some of the challenges that you brought up, I think the proposals in my eyes, they really favor incumbent financial institutions over some of the fintech startups. And why I say that is, I think if you are an entrepreneur or an engineer in Europe, on European soil, and you look at these new requirements, you may say that is a significant barrier for us to enter the market. And even under the e-money directives that, you know, they have the small, they have the sub threshold regimes, I think all of that may push some of the entrepreneurs and some of the tech startups to offshore their technology and perhaps not drive the competition, which I think Europe and Europeans are seeking. And if you look at from a payments sector perspective today, on the European continent, you've seen Visa and MasterCard and American Express get into the crosshairs of the European Commission and looking at anti-competitive type nature. So I'm all for pro-competition. One of the aspects of the project that really got me excited was that our project is open source. So over time, you can have individuals that build on the Diem blockchain. And I think that is different from other projects that are typically, you know, siloed in their technology stack.
So following on this discussion we just had about a Euro stablecoin, as you said, it really seems that you might not start with this one, obviously. What also was basically mentioned in the report I just explained, where it says that you might launch very soon, it said that you will launch with the US dollar stablecoin, or the US dollar Libra stablecoin. And here I would be very interested if like you basically have a preference to start with this, or if it's still open with which instrument you start. Because from my perspective, I thought, well, if Finmark then grants the license, it would obvious to start with a kind of Swiss franc Libra. At least this was my idea. So maybe you can elaborate on this one.
Yeah, if you take the world of crypto tokens, I believe there are over 1,600 that are out there. Only about 10% of those are stable coins. And so we want to go with a single currency stable coin construct. And when you take a look at the market caps and some of the liquidity that is out there, it's clear that the US dollar stablecoins are one of the big players. There are other players in stablecoins. And as you know, our multi-currency coin is an important aspect of this project. And in order to have a multi-currency coin, we need more than one single currency stablecoin. However, in the jurisdictions that we are assessing still at the moment, the US dollar seems to be ahead of kind of, I don't want to say the competition, but ahead of other stable coins in the market today. It would be wonderful. We're building this project for it to be interoperable, even with like CBDCs, for example, right? So in a perfect world, we would have stable coins, you know, all over. We would have a dollar stablecoin, a euro stablecoin, a pound stablecoin, a Singaporean stablecoin, a Swiss franc stablecoin. But you know, the market is not there yet. And I think the market will get there. I think in a few years when we have this discussion again, the question will be, why have you accepted so many stablecoins and not stuck to maybe just a handful of them? Will probably be the discussion. But right now, the US dollar stablecoin is definitely one that is in our crosshairs, as well as other G7 type of stablecoin. But again, it takes a lot of coordination. It takes a lot of regulation. And the jurisdictional aspect, I cannot stress enough the importance of the jurisdictional aspects that we will operate and turn on the system where we have a green light from the jurisdictions. And so for that, you know, I can't tell you in a month or two if the Europeans will change their posture, if the British will change their posture, if the Americans with the change of administration, if they change their posture. So unfortunately, I think it's still up in the air, but we certainly have a target single currency stablecoins construct that we want to go with for launch.
So you just mentioned that it will be possible to build on or upon the DM project or the DM blockchain. Can we maybe as a last block go into this direction a bit? And can you tell us a bit more about the specific use cases maybe you see for DM or DM coin and what it means that others can build upon this project and which use cases arise from this?
Absolutely. So the DM Association operates on an institutional level. Where the real innovation is going to occur is downstream. And so to specifically answer your question, the interoperability of and the design, having open source code, which you can go see on GitHub. In fact, we've updated all of our developer documentation last week on the developer site. So any developers listening to this, it's quite interesting to take a look at it. The innovation is going to be where you as an individual can build a digital wallet. You could partner up. In fact, one of the things I'm hoping to see is I'm hoping to see regional banks reach out to fintech startups and entrepreneurs to jointly build digital wallet providers that can offer consumer optionality. And so today, consumers, you know, they have a choice of using, you know, their smartphone to pay or cash or plastic. This is just one more way for individuals to pay for their goods. And so developing in the blockchain essentially would mean right now a developer can go and build a test wallet. They can integrate with the blockchain, accepting DM coins today. Now, if I were building a digital wallet today, I would ensure that to have consumer optionality, I build in other features in my particular wallet. For example, I would build insurance in my wallet. So I would offer insurance to my consumers. I would offer in partnership with, of course, an insurance company. In partnership with a bank, I would offer credit to have universal credit, which is clearly not mainstream today. So there are just a lot of innovation that can happen. And I'm going to go back to the M-Pesa example. Overnight, when M-Pesa was launched, you had new businesses that thrived. For example, if you walk in Nairobi, you will see individuals walking in around the streets with selling cards, scratch-off cards, to be able to top up your phone, to be able to pay with your phone. So that didn't exist before M-Pesa was developed. So I see the exact same thing happening here, which is this ecosystem of individuals building on the blockchain, partnering with you know, whether it's finance or insurance or other type of products that I can't think of. But that's where the real innovation is going to occur, is really downstream.
So this is basically kind of similar to Ethereum, right? With just a really regulated stablecoin and maybe a more remarkable and bigger infrastructure, right?
Yes. In fact, if you look at the announcement, I believe it was Visa made just last week with the partnerships with Ethereum, it was clear that Visa saw the opportunity in digital currencies and in a less friction type of payment system, and they partnered up with Ethereum. So yes, the one thing I will though stress again is the interoperability. You know, the current payment system that we have right now equates to me, Gmail owner email address, not being able to send you, Alex, an email because you're on another domain name, let's say Yahoo, or it takes me 3 to 5 days, or I have to pay a fee based on how quickly I want you to read my email. So that's the current state of payments. And I think unless for interoperability and open source code, I don't think you're going to solve for that.
That actually kind of leads me to one question I also had. The use cases you were describing were very much focused on a B2C world, so to say. Especially in Germany, I believe the discussion is less going on in the US, but especially in Germany, we are also having the discussion of programmable payments, right? Which is probably more a B2B use case. So we're thinking of an industry 4.0 thing, machines paying other machines directly, and these kinds of things. Is this something you also have in mind, or are you exclusively focusing on this B2C realm?
So the BTC realm is clearly the DNA of the DM Association and the remittances. In the future, I can see businesses developing their own digital wallets and being able to transact with one another, but that has not been kind of our purview right now. Remember, we offer the digital rails, and then you can have individuals and businesses that build on top of the digital rails. What they decide to innovate on, I think, will really dictate where the project long-term will go. But at the end of the day, this is a human-centric project. And one of the things that got me excited for this project is I care very much about financial inclusion, and I care very much about financial literacy. And when this project was announced last year, immediately it got kind of my heart, because I thought that it could be a solution for remittances and for lowering transaction fees. So I think this answers kind of your question of the B2B versus B2C, but it's not on a short-term horizon, but I think businesses will want to adapt to lower transaction fees, which in the end really affects their bottom line. And it's currently completely opaque to the consumer. So when a consumer goes and purchases something with their Visa, they don't realize that the merchant is paying 3% or 4% or 5% with American Express and other type of payments. But if the merchant offered a discount, for example, by paying with a DM coin, for example, then I think merchants are going to benefit from that.
I would have one more question, Julian, also with regard to this kind of change in your vision. And you also mentioned before that this is kind of a digital infrastructure, digital marketplace you want to establish here. So how can I basically imagine this? So that I basically have an infrastructure where I can do payments, where I also have, you explained this, a digital wallet. Or a digital ID, right? So maybe also some ID which is maybe issued by some government institution, for example. Is this what you think about when you say marketplace, or is there something? Am I missing something here?
No. So I think to provide more transparency, I will kind of walk you through a little bit what the this ecosystem would look like. So if I'm an individual and I want to essentially leverage the DM network, how would I go about doing that? So I would, one, look at any type of digital wallet provider or virtual asset service providers that are out there that accept the DM coin. So I would download that particular application. The second thing I would do is I would either link a traditional bank account that I have, or we can foresee debit card, purchasing a debit card at a store, for example, and then loading up on DM coins on the particular wallet, and then using these DM coins at the merchants that accept it. Now, the way we are seeing it is the marketplace that I'm talking about is going to be individuals and businesses that decide to build a digital wallet, that decide to accept a DM coin. Right now, if you take a look at the private sector, a few weeks ago, PayPal, for example, with their 350 million users, decided to offer cryptocurrencies to their users so that they could buy and hold and use digital assets. So PayPal could choose to also accept DM coins. That is a business decision. The benefits, I think, are going to be lower transaction fees than what you're currently seeing. Therefore, I think this marketplace is going to develop, and this ecosystem is quickly going to develop with individuals that want to transact with DM coin to save on transaction fees.
Mm-hmm. And we also already focused on the transactions. I think one important aspect of transactions in general is like the level of data privacy, right? So if we transact with cash, for example, today, it's kind of anonymous. So just the two transaction parties involved basically see the data. And so you can be sure that no third party really looks at the data. How are basically in the DM or Libra world anonymous payments also possible, because you're developing your own blockchain? There are cryptographic tools to also enable autonomous payments. Is this something you also consider? Because last year it has been said that Libra will actually, or the transaction data will not be used for business purposes by the members of the Libra Association. So what's your stance towards data privacy on transaction data? Because this is, at least in Germany, a very important and a heavily discussed topic, as you can
imagine. No, well, you promised me some tough questions and you're coming with them, so I appreciate them very much. So from the outset, I think we've been committed to create a payment system that's legally compliant, that is safe, that's consumer friendly, and that's committed to supporting all the efforts by the regulators and the central banks and the lawmakers to ensure that we fight against money laundering, terrorism financing, you know, AML, and all these type of things. The way we're designing and building the DM blockchain, it's using a privacy by design approach. And it does take into account the privacy considerations. Now, where we stand right now in privacy is, you know, we're continuing to analyze all of the applicable data controllers and processors on the DM blockchain. We are still assessing the best approach on how to address some of these issues. You know, it's been clear from regulators that they want to ensure that in addition to being compliant, that they want to know, you know, who is sending, who is receiving, who is part of the network. And so over time, we're hoping to grow this network while new technologies and solutions are developed in EKYC and in some of the digital identities that you talk about, but we don't have all the keys to the kingdom. We know that, and it's not overnight. We won't turn on the switch and then everybody in the world will be able to transact on the DM blockchain. That is just not the case. And so I actually see a gradual ramp up as we continue to work with global stakeholders and regulators to get more and more individuals using the DM blockchain. So It's not a one-stop black and white type of deal with privacy, but it's something that we take at the core of the project, knowing how important it is to individuals.
Julian, final question. So I'm living in Switzerland and Jonas lives in Germany. Let's assume I want to send Jonas some money for Christmas next year, not this year, but in 2021. Do you think will I be able to do this with a Libra, a DM coin? I don't care about the currency, right? But will I be able to do it with a DM coin, or do I still have to use TransferWise or some other service to do that?
Well, Alex, it's a great question. And I've always been an optimist and I've always been hopeful. So my answer is I sure hope that you can send a DM coin from Germany to Switzerland. Now, regulators, as you know, they have something else. Unfortunately, we can't push them one way or another. But you know, here's the thing with Europe, Alex. I really believe that 6 months in this space is like 5 to 10 years in other industries. And so I see through continued collaboration, submission of information to the Commission and to the ECB and the Bundesbank and other key players in Europe that we'll be able to mitigate the risks that they've brought up. And if MiCA regulation stays in place, then at least it also gives us a clear path into operating in Europe, which we appreciate. And to be honest, you know, is it better to not have any regulation and then launch a project which you then need to shut down? Or is it better to have, you know, a comprehensive regulation that takes you a little bit longer to assess, but then that you can implement and know exactly where you stand? I think the latter for a project that wants to operate in the long term is a better proposition than the former. So I'm very much hoping that you'll be able to send some money when Jonas goes skiing in the Swiss Alps sometime next year. But maybe in 6 months we can have an updated renewal podcast with both of you to see where we stand.
I was just about to suggest that, so that's great. We will definitely come back to this offer. But apart from this, Julian, thanks a lot for being here today, and also thanks a lot for being so open in answering our questions. Really appreciate that. And then, yeah, I will just say let's meet again at this very place in 6 months.
Brilliant. Well, danke sehr für everything.